Welcome to a special edition of the Strategy Driven Podcast, an interview with Jim Champy, author of Inspire, Why Customers Come Back. On behalf of the entire Strategy Driven team, I'd like to welcome you to this special edition of the Strategy Driven Podcast, an interview with Jim Champy, author of Inspire, Why Customers Come Back. The Strategy Driven Podcast focuses on the tools and techniques executives and managers can use to improve their organization's alignment and accountability to ultimately achieve superior results. These podcasts elaborate on the best practice and warning flag articles found on the Strategy Driven website at www.strategydriven.com. In this special edition podcast, Jim Champy, Chairman of Consulting at Perot Systems, shares with us his insights on how to define a consistent value proposition that impassions and continuously engages and retains customers. So now, without any further delays, let's get started. We are privileged to be joined by Jim Champy, author of Inspire, Why Customers Come Back, and Chairman of Consulting at Perot Systems. Jim is recognized throughout the world for his work on leadership and management issues and on organizational change and business reengineering. Jim's first book, Reengineering the Corporation, A Manifesto for Business Revolution, sold more than 3 million copies and spent more than a year on the New York Times bestseller list. He also authored the bestseller Reengineering Management, The Mandate for New Leadership, which was recognized by Business Week as one of the top 10 best business books of 1995. His columns and articles appear in such magazines as Forbes, Computer World, Sales and Marketing Management, Leader to Leader, and Baseline. Jim, welcome to the Strategy Driven Podcast.
Nathan, it's very good to be with you, and thank you for your interest in my work, and particularly in the new Inspire book.
I am thrilled to have you on the podcast, and I really enjoyed your book. I especially enjoyed all of the great actual, I'll say, business examples.
But thank you.
The experiences that you share in the book, and there are some companies like Zipcar that I, to be honest, didn't know existed before, and then sure enough, after I read Inspire, as I'm walking into my office one day, here they have an office in the first floor of my building.
Uh-huh.
So
you know it was a wonderful opportunity, Nathan, the research for this book and for the series that I'm actually doing of books like Inspire, to see some of these companies that are not necessarily broadly known, at least not yet, but that have wonderful business models that are in fact inspiring to their to their customers. So it was exciting to find companies like Zipcar. I also write in Inspire, as you know, about a company called The Big Green Egg that is based near your home in Georgia.
I know
a company I had never heard of until I began the research for this book.
Oh yeah, and they make a wonderful product. And for our listeners who don't know, the Big Green Egg is it's a grill, but it's a special grill based on a terracotta pot grill that came from the Orient that was brought to the U.S. But yes, certainly a very popular article down here throughout the South and really throughout the country.
That's right. And Nathan, what was particularly inspiring about the Big Green Egg story was how its customers were so inspired and loved the product so much that they are the principal salespeople for this company. You know, the Big Green Egg is a company that did little or no advertising through traditional channels over the years and still does very limited amount of advertising. but it's its customers that sell for them. And, you know, you can see that if you go onto their website. You can kind of see their contributions in terms of recipes and ideas and excitement that they have about the product. So it's that kind of a product that that just really inspires its customers, not only to use the product, but to go out and sell.
Oh, absolutely. I know people at work talk to me about their big green eggs all the time.
Yes.
So I'm actually kind of on the edge. You know, I'm thinking about do I replace the grill and do I make the leap to get a big green egg? So
got to be a serious cook, Nathan, but that's fine.
Yeah. Well, Jim, to start out our conversation, I was hoping you could share with our audience what you have found makes an organization inspiring such that it continuously engages and retains its customers.
Nathan, as you might expect in the research for this book, I found many ways in which companies inspire their customers and engage them so that they'll keep coming back.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, if there was one single thing that I think all the companies in this book have done and represent that's inspiring, that creates the sense of inspiration for their customers, it's that they really, at the very deepest level, appeal to the value of their customers. You know, oftentimes, we talk about offering a good price, high quality, and value for what we do.
Sure.
But if you look at these companies, they go beyond that. They really understand what's important to their customers at a deep value level, and have crafted either a set of processes or an offering that really appeal to those customer values. And they do it. Mm-hmm. They do it, and they execute in very different ways, but it's a value-based proposition. You know, I write about a company in the book called Stonyfield Yogurt. And if you look at what Stonyfield does, it's got a crusade that really appeals to its customers' values, in that case, particularly around the environment. I write about a company called GoDaddy that really has seen the need, the customer, consumer need, to simplify the complexity of dealing with the internet if you want to be a player on the internet. I write about a company called Honest Tea that fundamentally appeals to the sense of honesty of its customers. You know, it's in the beverage business, but it is just consistently honest in how it represents its product content, and how it treats its suppliers of tea. In fact, there's a wonderful story and reference that I make in the book of one of the customers of Honest Tea, writing to the company and saying, "You are so honest, I wish you were my bank. I wish you were my bank." But all of these companies, Nathan, at the very basic level, have discovered a sense of value of their customers and have programmatically, through process and through their product, appeal to those values. That's what they do.
Okay.
Not superficial. It's very deep. It's very deep.
Yes. And to continue on with that thought, for each of the companies that you highlight in the book, you present a set of rules of engagement that really highlights the things that particular company embodies. And as I read Inspire, time and time again, these rules of engagement struck me as being just so very customer-centric.
Absolutely.
They focused on the customer. Just that was their business.
Yes.
Focus on the customer. Jim, do you find a couple of the principles that are customer-centered that kind of flow throughout all the companies that you've studied and worked with that are kind of the must-dos that business leaders have to adhere to in order to make their company inspired?
You know, Nathan, there was one principle in particular that flowed through all of these companies, and that is the principle of authenticity.
Okay.
And what I mean by that is really being true in everything you do to what you profess to be. There's a condition we live under today in running companies that involves both the good and the challenge of the internet. Of course, the opportunity the internet gives us is to be out there with our customers in ways that we have never been before. But the internet is also the place where customers go to tell the truth. And
yes.
to really, you go into almost any site now, any product site, and what do you see? You see customer testimonies, both good and bad. And then you find neutral sites that, you know, that are just very pure in what they say. And so, you know, the internet police are out there, but that's not certainly the sole reason for being authentic. It's because, you must be authentic because you actually begin with what I had observed earlier about the need to really understand your customers' values and what those values are. And then you hopefully put together a proposition that appeals to those values. You express your beliefs and you stick to them. You stick to them. So that principle of authenticity is, I think, the most critical and consistent principle across all of these companies. But let me go a little further into what authenticity really means operationally, because, you know, we can all say, hey, we're authentic. We do as we profess. But look, first, you know, that authenticity must pervade everything you do, from formulating your products to your relationships with your people and customers and suppliers, you know, to how your company operates. So when you look at a company like Stonyfield that says, hey, we are environmentally pure, Stonyfield has to be, and it makes that such a prominent part of their proposition.
Yes.
It just has to be environmentally pure in everything that it does. Everything. And if you go into Stonyfield and look at its operations, that's what you see. Second, being authentic really requires a degree of openness and transparency, you know, that not all companies are comfortable with. You know, I've for years believed that most companies were designed on the principle of opaqueness, not transparency.
Sure.
You go into large companies, and in fact, they're more likely to be protective of who they are and how they're operating than open. Where, you know, I think these are the days of transparency where where it actually benefits you to be open about what you're doing, fully open to your customers, to suppliers, to your, you know, to your employees and associates. And it's almost a corollary principle to that of authenticity. Transparency is very important. And, you know, when you think about the companies that you really respect, it's the companies that are transparent. But, you know, the third thing about authenticity is, of course, things must work in a business context. Most companies are for-profit companies. So if you're a company like Honest Tea, and you want to be honest in how you deal with, you know, your suppliers, particularly, you know, the farmers out there who are growing your tea in some distant land, it still has to be a profitable arrangement for them and for you. And so there's an element of authenticity that says it must really operate in a business context. And then finally, you know, you have to remember, as you think about your proposition and how customers think about you, it's the customer who defines who you are, not you. I've almost become cynical about advertising campaigns that try to kind of put a spin on what the company is. Well, today the customer knows. The customer knows. And spin has no place in your appeal to customers. So it's a long answer to your question, but it all comes back, I think, particularly to the Inspire examples, the authenticity, Nathan. That's the principle that I think they're based on.
Well, that is great. That is absolutely great. And Jim, besides a principle-based rules of engagement, you know, I was struck by some of the rules of engagement that were programmatic or process-based, like metrics matter. So I was wondering if there were programs or processes, again, like metrics or a decision-making approach, that inspiring companies, generally speaking, typically possess.
You know, Nathan, almost all of the companies I write about in Inspire, some of the companies, in fact, several of the companies that I wrote about in the book and this series that came before Inspire called Outsmart, most of the companies had superb processes around customer service. And customer service was represented a set of processes that kind of goes beyond the norm. And they were and present a wonderful combination of what I would call high tech and high touch. You know, there's sometimes an assumption out there operating today that you can kind of, you know, create a website and just give your customers digital access to everything you do that will answer every question that a customer has. But the really smart companies, Nathan, have processes that have a very high degree of customer touch, of high touch. Now, those processes are expensive. I've got to tell you that.
Yes.
And again, if you look at these companies, what allows them to, frankly, pay for those front-end customer processes that are service-oriented are highly efficient operations. You know, I write in Outsmart, in the Outsmart book, about a company called SmartPack, that really deals with providing veterinary supplies to, you know, and supplements for horse lovers. You know, almost everybody who's works on answers the customer phone at that company has had some degree of veterinary training. And by the way, it's a fast-growing company, even in these hard times. And people will call that company just to get advice about what to do with a sick or ailing horse. And in some research I'm doing for, you know, for the next book in this series, you know, I interviewed the chief financial officer of Zappos, you know, the shoe company, the internet shoe company.
Yes.
A company that's just recently been acquired, actually, interestingly, by Amazon, because I think Amazon recognized it didn't know how to be in the shoe business. But, you know, to get directly to your question around metrics, if you look at the kind of processes that Zappos has around metrics, it doesn't just measure customer satisfaction. It measures who comes back and how many customers actually return.
Sure.
And, in order to, you know, incent customers to do that, it actually instructs its customer service representatives to spend an extended time of on the phone with customers. You know, a lot of companies, Nathan, get it wrong. What they do is they measure how many calls a service representative handles every day.
Absolutely.
And, you know, if the service representative hasn't done, 100 calls, they beat up the service representative. Where what you want to do is have the service representative engaging your customer on the phone. So, you know, the Zappos folks say to the service reps, hey, spend all the time you need to with that customer. Solve a customer problem. Develop a relationship with the customer. You know, send them a birthday card if you know when their birthday is. And so it's a form of engagement that's based on high touch. But, you know, behind it, Nathan, is a wonderful combination of process and technology. Very sophisticated process and technology behind all of these, all of these customer touch points.
But, sure.
Yeah, the processes are there, but the best processes are designed around customer service.
Yeah, and you know, as you were mentioning that and spending the time with the customer, a couple things came to mind, and one of which is I had seen a study on cellular phone service.
Yes.
And the average cost to gain a customer is like $400 per customer.
Yes.
And I'm willing to bet that an extra 15 minutes of customer service time does not equate to $400.
That's right.
But if they lose that customer, they're going to have to spend $400 to get another one to come back.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And you and I have probably both had issues if our, if something's wrong with a, with a link that we have and we want to get it fixed. And we don't want to be on the phone for an hour or be, you know, kind of moved around from customer service rep. We want someone who can fix it for us.
Yeah.
I've had good experiences and I've had bad experiences.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
and
yeah.
The bad experiences, and actually in that realm, in that market, the experiences which kind of confront me with complexity are experiences I don't want. I want someone who's going to fix it for me.
Absolutely. And I also want someone, you talk about the harmonizing of technology with customer service. I don't want to be asked what my phone number and account number is 10 times by
That's
five
right.
different people.
That's right.
I expect all that technology to be integrated so that when I call, you have it and you know about me right in front of you. And some organizations just do that beautifully.
That's right. And Nathan, the organizations that do that beautifully and do it well, have actually a combination of what I call people, process, and technology that works. They got very, very well-designed processes, very thoughtfully designed. They have very good supporting technology infrastructure. So once you give them your account number, your telephone number, boy, that shows up on the screen of every service representative who works on your case. And thirdly, they've got, again, people who are trained to solve the problem and who have are trained with the customer sensibilities, so that that person's going to stay on the phone with you until the problem is solved. So if you want superb operations today, it's a combination of people, process, and technology. You got to do all three.
All three. Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, Jim, moving on away from technology and just kind of bubbling up a little higher in the organization,
sure.
One thing that struck me as I went through Inspire was that the companies really had an inspiring leader. And if they weren't born, as it were, as a entrepreneurial startup with an inspiring leader, they became inspiring companies when a new inspiring leader came in and took the reins.
That's right.
Are there some common, whether they're personality traits or styles or characteristics that these inspiring leaders have that they can lift their companies up?
There are, Nathan, and let me give you a few of them that I think these leaders, these characteristics and qualities that these leaders share. First, there's a certain quality around ambition that all of them have.
Okay.
And, it isn't just an ambition, to get rich, to create wealth, to create a company and sell it. There's actually a quality of ambition in what they do for, around the success of the company. And it isn't about their personal success. It's about what the company really achieves, again, not just financially, but for its customers and in its markets. You sense that when you go and talk, and I did have the pleasure of interviewing the leaders of all of these companies that I write about. You just see that, their ambition was around, growing the quality and purpose and impact of their company. So there's that ambition was shared with the executive team. They kind of drove that ambition deep into the organization. So it was quite wonderful to experience. Second, it was quite interesting. The leaders of these companies are very intuitive in the way they act. Certainly, they look at numbers. They, as we said earlier, they look at metrics. But, in the end, they're walking in the marketplace. Peter Drucker used to have a wonderful expression in which to say managers have to walk in the marketplace. They walk in the marketplace enough so that they develop very good sensibilities about what to do. So that at the moment of truth, when they got to answer a question or they got a crisis, their intuitions work for them, and they depend on their intuitions. And so they're very intuitively driven, but that takes, that takes a presence and a focus in the marketplace. Thirdly, they're all surprisingly calm. They recognize there's risk, particularly if they're growing. There's one of these businesses that companies I write about that's growing. There's implicit and inherent risk every day in what they do, but they're very calm about that, and they understand the nature of risk and what they do. Fourth, they're very innovative. They tend to be very innovative, but focused in their thinking. So their innovation is around the product or business they're in. For instance, Zipcar is incredibly innovative in kind of perfecting its business model and consistently offering more kinds of vehicles to their customers, more locations, easier access, more convenience. There's a constant stream of innovation, and that's top-down driven. And finally, Nathan, these leaders are very engaging inside their companies. So that, when you get inside the companies and you talk to other people, you see how engaged other people are in the crusade or the campaign that the company's involved in. So they don't hold, it's not one man or one woman shows, all right?
Okay.
They deeply engage the people in their companies. I'll tell you a brief story of about one of the companies I wrote about in the Outsmart book, a company called Smith & Wesson, manufacturer of handguns. One of the older companies that I've written about in the series of books. I actually visited the Smith & Wesson manufacturing plant out in Springfield, Massachusetts, when I was doing research for the series of books. And I walked the factory floor, with one of the executives. And when I got to the place where these handguns are actually assembled, there are people, as you might expect, just sitting at benches. It's not an automated process to put the final handgun together. By the way, a lot of the milling is automated, but in the very end, someone's got to put this handgun together. By the way, I'm not a gun person. I've never fired a gun. So this was a bit of a frightening process, a visit for me. But I'm watching these folks assemble guns, and one of them turns to me and says, you know, it used to take us, you know, X number of days to assemble this gun. Now it takes us Y number of days. And you know, Mr. Champion, in a month, it's going to take us less than that. They were really proud, Nathan, of the fact that they were online, you know, redesigning the processes, and they were engaged. These are people on the manufacturing line engaged in the redesign, constant redesign and perfection of the processes for assembling these guns, getting cycle time, you know, further and further down. Sure. It was actually very inspiring for me. You know, you see people on the assembly line just make, you know, perfecting the efficiency and effectiveness of their work. By the way, when you get it to work right, as Smith & Wesson was, you know, during the time of the visit, because they were reducing cycle time, they weren't eliminating jobs. They were actually selling more guns. And so they were, you know, they were hiring people. They were hiring people.
Wow.
So it's kind of the perfect, you know, the perfect condition. But, you know, it's a sign of an executive team, you see, that has deeply engaged in a leader that has inspired people internally as well as externally. It's another characteristic of leadership. It's how you engage people inside your company. But those are some of the qualities they all share.
Oh, great. Great. And I guess the question I have, too, then, is around sustainability.
Yeah.
Because eventually all leaders do depart. You know, they might retire or they are offered another opportunity, as does happen.
Yes.
What steps do these leaders take then to position their organization to continue to be inspiring after they make that transition and another leader has to come in?
You know, Nathan, a lot of the qualities I just described to you about leaders are in fact behavioral, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now you can embody, you know, behavioral, you know, qualities in processes. And so one thing you can do is, you know, you build superb customer processes. You build very efficient processes that allow you to pay for good customer service. You actually do things operationally that represent your behaviors. But ultimately, what you want to do to make sure that there's sustainability is build into the culture, into what your people think, the same kind of values as you have.
Yes.
But the good, the bad news about behavior and values, and I've always believed this in companies, is that they are top-down driven. If you want to know why customers get treated badly, if you see customers get treated badly, look to the top of the organization.
Mm-hmm.
And you often see a person who doesn't care, really doesn't. Ultimately, they may speak to it, but they may not behave and execute in ways that, you know, speak to the importance of customers. But values get driven tops down. And so, you know, you can drive, hopefully, good values deep into your organization so that when you leave, they're still held by the enterprise. Now, having said that, because values get driven tops down, if I'm running a company and I know I'm going to retire at some point, and I want to make sure that the behaviors of that company are sustained after my departure, I look for a successor in my role who shares my values. And so I build a management team that actually have a shared set of values for whom hopefully, or from which hopefully my successor emerges. So, you know, the quick answers to the questions, build processes that really embody the behaviors, drive the behaviors deep into the organization so they're broadly shared, and thirdly, look for a successor, hopefully plan for a successor that shares your values. That will sustain it. That will sustain it, Nathan. And you do see companies where, you know, these operations and values have been sustained through really through successive leadership teams.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. And I couldn't agree more. I firmly believe that an organization's culture is just so highly reflective of the people or the individual who are leading that organization.
That's right.
It's almost a reflection of them.
It is. Very much so. Very, very much so.
Yeah. Well, Jim, through our conversation, we've talked, or we've at least briefly mentioned several of your other books, Reengineering the Corporation, Reengineering Management, and Outsmart. Mm-hmm. Could you tell us a little bit about these books and how they can be used or how they complement Inspire?
Sure. And Nathan, you know, in doing that, I must warn you that I'm going to take you through the whole development of my own thinking over time, because these books kind of represent my experiences in business and in work and you know, in my thinking. And
sure.
And so let me go back to the reengineering book that, that came, and that Mike Hammer and I, and my like co-author wrote in the, and really researched in the late 1980s and wrote and finally published in the early 1990s. You know, that book came out of a time when we were able to see how companies had been in some ways overly structured, become overly complex in the way they were operating, had very high operating costs. It was also, interestingly, a recessionary time, Nathan, when companies were looking to find, new ways to compete and new ways to become more efficient. And Mike and I just saw all the inefficiency and complexity and bureaucracies that had built up in companies. And we stepped back and said, look, there has to be a different way of doing work and about thinking of work in a fundamentally different way than this kind of highly functionalized, structured way that work had been done. We were inspired by seeing some emerging examples of how companies were doing work in different ways. Toyota, by the way, had already begun its redesign of work in the automotive industry. And interestingly, we saw people in Toyota doing the same work with about 10% of the people that Ford was doing the work, okay?
Okay.
And we said, well, what's different? What's different? We started to see that in places like Toyota and in other places, work could be organized, and in fact, we argued should be organized, mm-hmm. from the perspective not of a department of function, but in terms of process.
Sure.
And that the opportunity was to fundamentally redesign work from a process perspective, not just a kind of a localized task perspective, but by a process perspective. And that was the argument in the reengineering book. We said, look, it's time to step back and fundamentally redesign the nature of work from a process perspective, and to do it in ways to dramatically improve the productivity and quality and service levels of what you do in a company. Now, Nathan, as you experienced the reengineering days in the early 90s, some people understood what we were up to, that we were arguing that work had to be fundamentally redesigned. And there were wonderful examples, and still are wonderful examples, of companies that are doing that. At the same time, there were some managers who didn't get it, and some journalists who didn't get it, and who saw reengineering as just being an exercise in downsizing. And in fact, I remember an executive from one company coming to me and saying, Jim, we don't know how to do this reengineering stuff. So what we do is we downsize parts of our company because we have to compete and get costs down.
Yes.
And then we leave it to the people who are left to figure out how to do the work differently. Well,
that's
one way to do it.
That is one way to do it.
Yeah, but typically what you see is a degradation, in the performance of a company when that happens. You lose your talent, you're not making smart decisions. And so I could see that we needed to be more prescriptive around how this work was done. And so I wrote the second book, the Reengineering Management book, with a desire to speak directly to managers and say, look, you got to change the way you think. You can't think just hierarchically. That's not what process redesign is about. You have to engage your people in fundamentally different ways. You have to be much more, you have to develop your own technology sensibilities, because technology is becoming the great enabler of process change.
Yes.
By the way, Nathan, if I were to rewrite the reengineering book today, it would have a much stronger component of technology-enabled change. Because when we wrote that book, remember, we didn't have the internet. We didn't have companies that could, operate the way the companies in the Outsmart book and Inspire book operate.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have the ubiquity and pervasiveness of technology that we have today.
Okay.
But I wrote the Reengineering Management book to try to get managers to change the way they think and the way they work.
All right.
Now, in the last several years, because we have the pervasiveness of technology, And because, you know, we really have a condition, as Thomas Friedman describes, as the flat world.
Mm-hmm.
The world is much more global today than it was when we wrote the reengineering book. I felt that there was a need for companies to step back and not only rethink their processes, but to rethink the nature, the fundamental nature of their product and service, as well as how they operate their processes. And so I started to undertake, with the support of the Financial Times Press, my publisher for the series of books.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
I started to undertake research to look at how companies were developing new business models, where I defined, you know, in the series of books, a business model as a combination of what a company offers and sells, as well as how it operates. And so, Nathan, I looked at over, and I'm still looking, I looked at over 1,000 companies that were growing at a, you know, at a very high rate, very high clip, even during these recessionary times, and that I felt were operating in fundamentally different ways, had new business models. And those are the companies that served as the basis for the research and the writing in both the Outsmart book, then the Inspire book, and what will be a third book that I believe will be titled Deliver. Now, the Outsmart book principally looks at where ideas come from and how companies are implementing these ideas in new ways. And in some ways, the Outsmart book is kind of a strategy book. It's, all right, here's the idea. This is what we have to do to implement it. So if you read Outsmart, you'll also find a number of companies you will have never heard of. Oh, they're small to medium-sized companies that are emerging.
Okay.
But this whole series of books is intended to look at new business models through various lenses. And the Inspire book looks at, in some sense, looks at these business models from a marketing lens. How do you engage customers in new ways? The Deliver book, the book that will come next, really looks at how companies are executing and changing in different ways.
Okay.
So the examples in the Develop book you'll find, or the Deliver book, I'm sorry, the Deliver book, will be examples of larger existing companies that are going through and taking themselves through some form of dramatic operating change. But again, this whole series of books is around going beyond process, going beyond traditional management thinking, and looking at new business models and how I think companies need to operate in fundamentally new ways, given the environment that we're in. By the way, an environment, as you know, of deep economic challenge, an environment of the flat world. The world is still very flat, and the flatness isn't going to go away in spite of the kind of protectionist language we hear these days. And thirdly, a world in which technology is the great enabler. It's a long answer to your question, but that's a progression of my thinking.
Okay.
On the books.
Oh, that is great. That is great. And when you talk about technology helping facilitate these processes and process change, I mean, in my own personal career, I've helped a number of companies implement enterprise resource planning or ERP systems to do just that, help streamline processes and facilitate their execution to make them more efficient.
Absolutely. Yeah. And again, Nathan, if you think back to when we wrote the reengineering book, see, we didn't have the internet. You know how those ERP, you know, processes and systems can now work. Because you know that you can work across companies, you work across suppliers.
Mm-hmm.
So much more is possible. You know, people often will say to me, or, you know, a journalist will say to me, well, isn't the age of reengineering over? And I'll say, look, I think the age of reengineering is just beginning.
Yeah.
And what we're going to be able to accomplish in fundamental work and process change is just beginning. But having said that, I want to go back and add the caveat from the earlier part of our discussion.
Mm-hmm.
Don't forget high touch. Don't forget high touch.
Yes.
It isn't just about technology. Technology allows you and enables you to touch your customers in much more intimate ways. So don't forget, you know, the high touch part of it.
Yeah. It's a tool, but we have to, as people, do the touch part.
Absolutely.
Yeah, excellent. And, you know, I'm going to be watching for when Deliver comes out.
Thanks.
We'll hope to get you back on the show again, too.
Working on it now.
Excellent. Well, great. Jim, before we close, you do have a website. It's www.jimchampy.com. That provides a lot of additional resources on how to inspire and bring customers back. Could you tell us a little bit about the website and its resources?
Sure, Nathan. Look, first, you can certainly find references to all of the books that I have written, the reengineering book, the reengineering management book, this series of books. A book, by the way, I wrote several years ago with Nathan Narea, professor of the Harvard Business School, called The Arc of Ambition. You know, Nathan, it's a wonderful little book. Didn't get a lot of attention at the time. But it speaks to that, at the point I was making earlier about one of the principal qualities of all the leaders of these companies. It's about the importance and quality of ambition. But you can find references in on my website to those books. You can find articles that I've written on several of the topics we've talked about today. You can find some video clips of my speaking to most recently to the Inspire and Outsmart books, and to other topics that from time to time I'm asked to write about and that I speak about. So it's a catalog of my work.
Great. Well, Jim, this has been just a phenomenal interview. I have really enjoyed being able to talk to you, and I want to thank you for the time you've spent with me and our audience today, and for sharing your insights on how we in the business community can better engage and retain our customers. And I think our audience already knows, but I really enjoyed Inspire, not only for the depth of insight, but the richness of the examples that you had in the book brought all these principles and concepts just to life. It was just easy to go then and see, hey, this is how it's done. And I love that about your book. I do hope that our audience will go out and pick up a copy of Inspire for themselves and then use the rules of engagements and the principles that you share to better engage their own customers. So thank you very much for joining us.
Well, Nathan, it's been a pleasure. Really, I've enjoyed our discussion today. And to your point, I've always believed there's so much to learn from companies, smart companies that are out there executing really in unique and innovative ways. But companies at the same time are following some just fundamental good principles of management, Nathan. And and I believe that just as you point out, we can learn so much from these companies. And that's why I wanted to write about them and Inspire. So I appreciate your support and excitement for the book. Thank you.
Thank you. And we will look for Deliver when it comes out.
Great.
Thank you for joining us. We hope you enjoyed this special edition of the Strategy Driven Podcast. I would like to personally thank Jim Champy for being with us today and sharing his insights on continuously engaging and retaining customers. As always, we would appreciate receiving your feedback by email at podcast@strategydriven.com. If you enjoyed the show, please consider voting for us on Podcast Alley and visiting our website at www.strategydriven.com. You can find more information about Jim Champy and Inspire at www.jimchampy.com. Until next time, so long.